Dune, House Carino, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, Part 2. This book has 496 pages and is read by Michael Pritchard. Part 2 consists of pages 280 through 496. Dune, House Carino, by Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, Part 2. How long can one man fight alone? Far worse, though, to stop fighting completely. Kater Pilru, Private Journals, Fragment. Seated on an organic soft pad inside her snow shelter, Sister Christine considered her predicament. A cold blue glow globe floated just beneath the low ceiling. She wore a hooded orange sin-down jacket, cling trousers, thick boots. This was only her first day on the mountain, far from the Highliner crash site, far from anything at all. As part of her commando training, to stay in top physical and mental condition, she was required to go on regular wilderness hikes, pitting her survival skills against the elements. Before dawn, she had begun hiking up the 6,000-meter Mount Laojin, winding her way along wooded ridges, high meadows, rugged talus slopes, and finally negotiating a rocky glacier. She had brought along a small pack, minimal supplies, and her wits. It was a typical Bene Gesserit test. An unexpected weather shift had caught her in a whiteout on a boulder-strewn moraine, an open expanse with steep, snow-covered cliffs above, ripe for an avalanche. Christine had hollowed out a snow cave and crawled inside with her gear. She could adjust her metabolism enough to keep herself warm, even here. Breathing steam, letting a thin film of perspiration glisten on her skin under the blue glow globe, she took deep, relaxing breaths. At a double snap of her fingers, the light went out, immersing her in eerie, moon-white darkness. The blizzard roared on outside, a relentless onslaught that scraped against her small enclosure. She had been intending to enter a meditational trance, but suddenly the drone of the blizzard grew quieter, and she heard the unexpected vibration of an ornithopter. Within moments, the excited voices of women and the sounds of digging came from outside the shelter. The snowdrift broke away, exposing her shelter to the cold wind. Familiar faces peered inside. "Leave your gear here," one sister said, looking at Christine. "Mother Superior needs to see you right away." The young Bene Gesserit emerged from the shelter into the ragged end of the blizzard. The rocky peak of Mount Laojin was bedecked with a thick blanket of new snow. A large ornithopter perched on a flat area upslope, and she trudged through soft whiteness toward it. Mother Superior Harishka leaned out of the thopter hatch, waving her rail-thin arms. "Hurry, child, we can just get you to the spaceport in time for the next Highliner." Christine climbed in, and the two women sat side by side as the aircraft lifted off in a flurry of blown snow.
"What is it, Mother Superior?"
"An important assignment." With dark, almond eyes, the old woman peered at her.
"You are being sent to Ix. We have already lost one operative there, and now we have received disturbing information from Kaitane. You must learn what you can about the secret operations of the Tleilaxu and the Emperor. They have been scheming together on Ix."
Harishka placed a dry, wrinkled hand on the commando's knee.
"Discover the nature of Project Amal, whatever that is."
Wrapped in a protective trance that reduced her metabolism to near zero, Sister Christine huddled inside an orbital dump box as it braked through the atmosphere and cruised down to the surface of Ix, accompanied by a parade of sonic booms. Everything had happened very quickly. A Bene Gesserit makeup specialist had followed her onto the highliner, where she was disguised as a male for her protection, since no one had ever seen a Tleilaxu female. In addition, before she had fallen ominously silent, the Bene Gesserit spy, Miral Alekhem, had reported the disappearance of Ixian women on the Tleilaxu-controlled industrial planet. Now, using an electronic device she carried, the young commando guided the plummeting box several kilometers off course. After it skidded across an alpine meadow, finally coming to a halt, she worked her way out, sealed the container behind her, and shouldered her backpack, which contained weapons, food, and warm-weather survival gear. Wearing infrared contact lenses, she managed to gain entry to a ventilation shaft. Engaging the suspensor mechanism on her belt, Christine climbed inside and dropped, with no idea where the shaft led. In the darkness, she fell slowly, deeper and deeper, into the planetary crust. Finally, with frayed nerves and reflexes, she crawled into the subterranean world. She was on her own. Among the crowded, subdued population, she could easily distinguish the once proud Ixians from the Suboids, Tleilaxu overlords, and Sardaukar soldiers. The true Ixians spoke little to each other, kept their eyes averted, and shuffled along aimlessly. For 2 days, she explored narrow connecting tunnels, gathering information. In a short while, the efficient Christine developed a mental map of the city's comprehensive air circulation system, while discovering ancient security systems, most of which were no longer operable. She wondered where Sister Miral Alekhem might be now. Had the other Bene Gesserit infiltrator been killed? One evening, Christine watched a black-haired man steal packages from an unlit loading dock, hiding them inside a clogged vent. Though she wore infrared lenses, it struck Christine as extraordinary that he was able to move about with no illumination. The man knew the area extremely well, suggesting a long time spent here. As the furtive figure stashed packages, she studied him closely, detecting subtleties. This Ixian walked with a purpose, confident but wary. When he came close to her hiding place, she used the power of voice and whispered from the darkness, "Do not move. Tell me who you are." Paralyzed by the tone, Keter Pilru was unable to flee. Though he struggled to clamp his mouth shut, his lips moved of their own volition. In a low, agitated voice, he provided his full name. His mind spun as he tried to sort possibilities. Was this a Sardaukar guard, or a Tleilaxu security investigator? He could not tell. Now he heard a soft voice, and felt the warmth of someone's breath on his ear. "Do not fear me. Not yet." A woman. She forced him to reveal the truth. He told of his years spent fighting to restore Ix, how he had cared for Miral Alekhem, and how she had been taken by the vile Tleilaxu, and how Prince Romber would arrive soon. Christine sensed that Keter had more to say, but his words drifted off into a long silence. For his part, he perceived the strange woman moving around him, but couldn't see her, and still he was unable to move. Would she speak again, or would he feel a blade piercing his ribs and heart? "I am Sister Christine of the Bene Gesserit," she said at last. Keter felt a lifting of the mental shackles that had restrained him. In the light cast by a passing ground truck, he was surprised to see what appeared to be a slender man with close-cropped dark hair. A disguise. "When has the Sisterhood ever concerned itself with Ix?" Keter demanded. "You spoke eloquently of Miral Alekhem. She was also a sister. Kater could hardly believe this. In the darkness, he touched her arm. "Come with me. I will show you a safe place to stay." Darting in and out of shadows, he guided her through the once beautiful city. In the low illumination of artificial light, Christine's wiry body showed few feminine curves. She could pass as a man if she were careful enough. "I am glad you're with me," he told her, "but I fear for your life." An ignorant friend is worse than a learned foe. Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, Incoherence of the Philosophers. Wandering alone through the corridor outside her apartment, trying to escape the persistent attentions of medical sister Yosa, Lady Anirul bumped into Count Hasimir Fenring, just as he rounded a corner at a brisk pace.
Pardon me, my lady.
When he looked at the Emperor's wife, his flickering eyes assessed her weakened condition.
"So good to see you up and about. Good, very good. I heard about your illness, and your husband has been so worried."
Anirul had never liked this slippery little man. Suddenly, a chorus of voices in her mind encouraged her, and she could withhold her feelings no longer. "Maybe I would have a true husband if you did not interfere so much, Count Fenring." Recoiling in surprise, he said,
"Whatever do you mean? I spend most of my time away from Kaitane on business. How could I possibly interfere?"
His large eyes narrowed, analyzing her further. Impulsively, she decided to jab and parry with words, then watch for his reaction to learn more about him. "So tell me about Project Amal and the Tleilaxu, and Ix." Fenring's face showed just the hint of a flush.
"I'm afraid you must be suffering a relapse. Shall I call a souk doctor?"
She glared at him. "Shaddam doesn't have the foresight and intuition to develop such a scheme by himself, so it must have been your idea. Tell me, why are you doing this?" Though the Count appeared ready to lash out at her, he made a visible effort to calm himself. Automatically, Anirul adopted a subtle fighting stance, a barely perceptible shifting of her muscles. A well-placed toe kick could disembowel him. Fenring smiled even as he studied her closely. From living with Margaret, he had learned to watch for minute details.
"I am afraid your information is incorrect, my lady,
Although he carried a neuro-knife in his pocket, Fenring now wished for a more substantial weapon. He took a half-step backward and said in his calmest tone,
"With all due respect, perhaps my lady is imagining things."
He bowed stiffly and left in a great hurry. As Anirul watched him scurry away, the clamor of voices increased inside her skull. Finally, through the haze of drugs, after searching for so long, she heard old Lobia's familiar voice rising above the others.
"That was very human of you," the dead truth-sayer scolded. "Very human and very foolish."
As he disappeared into the maze of corridors, Fenring pondered damage control. In these unstable times, the Sisterhood could significantly undermine Shaddam's power base if they chose to turn against him.
"If the Emperor falls, I go down with him."
For the first time, Fenring considered that it might be necessary to kill Shaddam's wife. Quite accidentally, of course. Inside the Landsraad Hall of Oratory, noblemen and ambassadors had begun to speak openly of revolt. Representatives from great and minor houses stood in line for the podium, where they shouted red-faced or spoke with cold venom. The emergency session had already lasted a night and most of the following day without respite. Emperor Shaddam, though, was totally unconcerned. He sat unruffled in the elaborate seat reserved for him within the great hall.
The nobles fumed and talked among themselves, an ill-tempered, rowdy assemblage. Shaddam was disappointed to see their uncouth behavior. He lounged in the immense chair, his manicured hands folded on his lap. If this meeting went as planned, the emperor wouldn't need to say a word. He had already requested more Sardaukar troops from Seleucus Secundus, though he doubted they would be necessary to control this minor civil unrest. Somewhat recovered from her recent episodes, but still looking dazed, Lady Anirul sat in her subordinate seat, wearing a formal black Aba robe, as he had requested. Beside her stood the imperial truthsayer, Gaius Helen Mohiam, in a matching robe. Their presence clearly implied that the powerful sisterhood still supported Shaddam's reign. It was high time the witches followed through on their duties and veiled promises. Before the opening complaints from the Landsrad were heard, Shaddam's lawyers stepped forth and presented his position, citing appropriate precedents and technicalities. Next, a primary envoy from the Spacing Guild took the podium. The guild had transported Shaddam's warships to Rachiz for the attack on Corona, and they defended their decision to do so, referencing legal precedents of their own. Thanks to Shaddam's benevolence, the guild had reaped half of the recovered spice stockpile from Corona, and they would stand by House Carino. Shaddam sat with regal confidence. The president of Choam stepped forward after this, a man with stooped posture and a silvery gray beard. His voice carried loud and far. Choam supports the emperor's right to enforce order in the Imperium. The law against stockpiling melange has long been a part of the imperial code. Though many of you complain vociferously, every house is aware of it. He looked around the assemblage, waiting for any voices of dissent, then continued. The emperor issued repeated warnings that he intended to enforce this law. Yet, even after he took action against Zanovar for the same crime, Rachiz foolishly ignored the rule. The Choam president jabbed a sharp-nailed finger out toward the delegates. What evidence is there against House Rachiz? A nobleman shouted. We have the word of a Corino emperor. That is sufficient. The Choam president let his words hang in a confrontational pause. And, in private session, we have seen hollow images of the Rachizian stockpiles before they were confiscated. The president started to leave the podium, then stepped back, and added, The emperor's legal position is solid, and you cannot censure him to cover your own crimes. If any of you violate the stockpiling edict, you do so at your own peril. It is the imperial prerogative to use any means necessary to maintain political and economic stability, supported by the rule of law. Shaddam suppressed a smile. Anirul glanced at him, then back across the great hall and the throng of unruly Landsrad representatives. Finally, Chamberlain Beely Redondo boomed his sonic staff to restore order. Gazing out at the nobles, he announced, These proceedings are formally open. Now, who dares to speak against the emperor's actions? Shaddam's loyal staff members rose to their feet with scrolls and scribing pens, ready to take down names. The implication was clear. The simmering discontent settled to a murmur, and no one came forward to be the first. The emperor made a public show of patting his wife's hand, knowing he had won. For now. Never attempt to understand prescience, or it may not work for you. Navigator's Instruction Manual. Romber staggered out of the swirling spice gas, choking and coughing. His artificial lungs sounded ragged, too overworked to process the massive melange exposure. Spice residue thrummed through his mind, making it difficult to interpret the combined visual impulses of his organic eye and its prosthetic companion. He lurched two steps, leaned against a wall. Wearing a filter mask, Gurney Halleck pushed his way forward to help him. He guided the prince back into a corridor where the air was clean. An anxious flight auditor used a compact air jet to blast the powdery coating of melange from Romber's clothes. Touching a control on the side of his neck, the cyborg prince activated an internal mechanism that purged his lung filters. One of the root administrators grasped him by the shoulder.
"Can the navigator still function? Can he guide us out of here?"
Romber tried to speak, but in his muddled state of mind he didn't know how coherent his words sounded. "The navigator is alive but weakened. He says his spice gas is tainted." He took a deep, mechanical breath. "We need to replace the melange in his tank with a fresh supply." Hearing this, the guildsmen spoke quickly among themselves. The rotund banker seemed the most alarmed.
"The concentration of melange in a navigator's chamber is high. We don't have the resources."
The aged Mentat stood as if in a trance, checking data in his head, running through his memorized ship rosters.
"This Highliner carries over 1,000 vessels, but none are listed as spice transports.
Still, there must be a great deal of melange scattered in small portions throughout the ships in the hold," Gurney said. "What about all the passengers' personal possessions, all the dining galleys? We have to look everywhere."
The banker agreed. "Many noble families consume spice daily to maintain their health."
"Such supplies are not reported on passenger manifests, so we cannot be certain of the quantity available," the Mentat guildsman said. "In any event, dealing with all the passengers could take days."
"We will find a way to move faster. The navigator is very afraid," Romber said. "He says a great enemy is drawing closer. We are in danger."
"But from what?" the flight auditor said.
"I don't understand what could possibly be a threat to us out here."
The Mentat said, "Perhaps another intelligence, something not human?"
"The navigator may be hallucinating," one of the root administrators pointed out, sounding hopeful. "His mind is damaged."
The banker disagreed. "We cannot gamble on this. He has prescience. Perhaps we are in the path of a huge cosmic event, a supernova or something else, that will swallow us with it. We have no choice but to demand that all private passenger ships surrender their melange. We'll get the Waku and the security men started immediately."
"It won't be enough," said the old Mentat guildsman.
Impatient with the bickering and endless discussion, Romber spoke in a commanding tone and insisted, "Nevertheless, we will make it work." The mission went slowly. Despite the Highliner's obvious need, passengers were reluctant to surrender their precious melange, not knowing how long they might be stranded out here in uncharted space. To force the issue, the guildsmen enlisted security forces to scour ship after ship. But it was taking too long. Gurney Halleck went on his own to the upper Highliner deck, where he stood inside a plaz-walled enclosure. He had trudged from docking section to docking section, searching, listening, attempting to spot something none of the others would think to look for. While gazing out upon the congregation of vessels inside the hangar bay, he scrutinized every hull plate, every ship configuration, every serial number and insignia. The Guild Mentat had mentally reviewed all of the cargo manifests, and the other officials had accepted his assessment with dismay and resignation. But they failed to ask Gurney's question. What if there was an undeclared cargo of spice? He was no expert on spacecraft, but he studied the streamlined frigates, the sharp-angled military craft, the cube-shaped orbital dump boxes. Some ships proudly displayed the colors of noble families on their hulls. Other nondescript vessels were battered and dirty from age and overuse. Gurney focused on those in particular, raking his gaze from one to the next,
remembering his smuggler past when he had made unobtrusive journeys inside Highliner holds himself. With growing anticipation, he moved to the next observation deck for a better vantage. Finally, he spotted a small ship tucked behind a much larger frigate that bore the crest of House Mutelli. The dingy vessel was an outdated pinnace, a commercial craft used to haul salvage and other unimportant cargoes. Gurney studied the stains on the hull, looked at the enlarged engine compartments and repairs that had been made to the superstructure. He knew this unusual craft. He had seen it before. It was exactly what he'd been looking for. Accompanied by Guild security forces, Gurney and Romber led the way under a huge hull support buttress to the old pinnace. When the group demanded entrance, the captain and crew refused to acknowledge. However, before berthing aboard a Highliner, every vessel had to submit certain override codes to Guild manifest personnel. The pinnace hatch finally cracked open, and the security men thundered aboard. Gurney surged to the front of the group. The ragtag pinnace crew had armed themselves and taken up assault stations, ready to fire upon the intruders. But Gurney raised his arms, putting himself directly in the crossfire. "No! No weapons! Either side!" He gazed around at the scruffy men who looked like down-on-their-luck salvage workers. Marching deeper into the corridor, he glanced from one unfamiliar face to another, until finally he recognized a squat, stubble-cheeked man chewing on a stem-leaf plug. "Pen Barlow, you don't need your weapons with me." The defiant expression on the rugged man's face melted into a look of wonder. He spat out the end of his sodden plug and stared open-mouthed. "That Inkvine scar! Gurney Halleck, is it you?" The Guild security men waited anxiously, not sure what was happening. "I knew if I looked hard enough among the ships here, I was sure to find one of my old comrades." He came forward to greet his smuggling companion. Pen Barlow began to laugh loudly, braying like a pack animal, and pounded him on the back. "Gurney! Gurney!" Gurney Halleck gestured back in the direction of the cyborg prince, who approached in his cloak and cowl. "There's someone you need to meet. Allow me to introduce Dominic's son." Several smugglers gasped, for even those who had not served with Dominic Vernius knew of his legendary exploits. Romber thrust out his synthetic arm and clasped Pen Barlow's free hand in the half-handshake of the Imperium. "We need your help, if you're a friend of Gurney's." Barlow gestured toward his men. "Stand down, fools! Can't you see there's no emergency here?" "I need to know your true cargo, my friend," Gurney said gravely. "Is this vessel carrying what I think it is? Unless you've changed your ways since I left the smugglers, you may have the key to saving us all." The swarthy man looked down, as if considering whether to retrieve the stub of his stem-leaf plug from the deck and stuff it back into his mouth. "We heard the call, but thought it was some kind of trick." He met Gurney's gaze and shifted nervously on his feet. "Yes, we've got an undeclared cargo, and it's illegal to haul. Dangerous, even, with the Emperor's crackdown. We are all relying on Guild confidentiality here, myself included," Romber said. "These are extraordinary circumstances, and we are far beyond the reach of Imperial law." Gurney studied his comrade, not letting his gaze waver. "You have melange aboard, Barlow, to be sold to black marketeers at a fine profit." He narrowed his eyelids. "But not today. Instead, you'll buy us all our lives." Barlow glowered. "Yes, we have sufficient spice aboard for an emperor's ransom." Romber smiled, crinkling his scarred face. "That could be enough." The smuggling crew looked on, their faces stricken, as the Highliner security men hauled container after unmarked container of compressed spice
up to the top levels. Taking several guildsmen aside, Gurney negotiated for some compensation for the smugglers. The guild was notoriously frugal, and the amount they agreed to pay was not nearly full value, but the smugglers were in no position to argue. In the midst of all the activity, Romber stood outside the navigator's tank, trying to attract the attention of Demur. The mutated human lay slumped and barely breathing. "We must hurry," he called back to the others. Truman worked feverishly, draining the tainted spice from the tank. Afterward, other men converted containers of packed melange into aerosol and fed fresh gas into the chamber in long orange streamers. They hoped that this batch of uncontaminated spice would be enough to revive the navigator and give him the ability to guide the Highliner back into familiar space. "He has not moved in over an hour," said the flight auditor. Romber cleared the area again and went back inside the sealed chamber. Orange spice gas curled and flowed into the tank from vents high in the chamber. Moment by moment, visibility decreased, but the Ixian prince plodded toward the center of the navigator's tank, to the hulk of what once had been a dark-haired, handsome young man like his twin, Kater. Long ago they had both flirted with Romber's sister, Kylie Avernius. He recalled the twins, children of Ambassador Pilru. Everyone had been happy in those glory days of Ix. It all seemed like a dream, even more so because of the spice now seeping into his consciousness. Demur had been so proud to pass his examination to become a guild navigator, while Kater had been devastated at his failure and remained behind on Ix. Always on Ix. A past so distant it might never have happened. Romber spoke in a soothing tone, as if he were a medical practitioner. "We are replenishing your spice, Demur." Kneeling, he saw the navigator's glassy eyes. "We have found pure melange. Whatever was wrong will be fixed." The creature no longer appeared even remotely human. Distorted and atrophied, his body looked as if it had been remade by a sadistic sculptor of flesh. The bloated hulk stirred weakly and flopped, as helpless as a fish on a hot dock. Demur's face twisted, his strange mouth forming an odd expression. He sucked in mouthfuls of the potent spice gas. Romber's thoughts floated, and the movements of his mechanical arms and legs seemed slow, as if inhibited by thick liquid. The cyborg's artificial lungs labored. He needed to get out of the tank soon. "Will this help? Can this new spice let you see through fold space and bring us home?" "Must," Demur said, exhaling curls of smoke. "We are in danger. The enemy has seen us, approaches, wants to destroy." "Who is the enemy?" "Hatred. Extinguish us for what we are." Demur managed to bring his twisted body more upright. "Flee as far as possible." He turned, his tiny eyes surrounded by folds of waxy flesh. "I see the way now to bring us home." The navigator seemed to be consuming all of his strength for one last gesture. Demur squirmed closer to the vents that sprayed dense melange gas. He drew in a deep breath. "Must hurry." Instead of rushing to the hatch to escape, Romber helped him grasp the controls. The faltering navigator powered up the Holtzman engines, and with a sudden jerk, the Highliner shifted and then spun over, righting itself in space. "Enemy is near." And the great ship moved, or seemed to. Feeling a lurch in his stomach, Romber grasped the tank wall and sensed the transition as the powerful Holtzman field folded space, wrapping it around the Highliner in a precise manner.
The navigator completed his sacred assignment. The Highliner winked into view above the planet Junction. Demur had instinctively brought them back into the Imperium, back to Guild headquarters, to his only home since he had left Ix as a young man.
"Safe," Demur announced weakly.
Touched by the tremendous effort of the navigator, Romber went back to him, ignoring for the moment his own need to escape. Demur had used the last of himself to rescue everyone aboard.
"Kater."
With a long, hissing sigh that sounded as if his entire body were deflating, the navigator slumped to the floor of his chamber and did not move. With the cyborg prince crouched beside him, surrounded by potent melange gas, Demur died. Romber could say no farewells now, and knew he needed to leave the chamber before the melange overwhelmed him. His vision reeling, the organic parts of his body burning from saturation with spice, Romber staggered back toward the hatch. Demur's body dissolved into the orange spice fog and disappeared from sight. Justice? Who asks for justice in a universe crawling with inequity? Lady Helena Atreides. Private Meditations on Necessity and Remorse. Like shadows, four sisters in isolation approached Castle Caladan from the sea. They rode aboard a leaky fishing trawler, rather than a formal processional barge. It was early evening, and a pall of fading daylight lingered beneath a cloudy sky. Standing on the deck of the boat and gazing toward the cliff face and the castle above it, the sisters wore capes and loose-fitting jerkins made of the blackest cloth. Flexible gloves, leggings, and boots covered every centimeter of their skin. A fine-woven mesh of ebony fibers sewn around the rims of their hoods shrouded their faces. During the long voyage across the ocean on the trawler, the sisters had kept to themselves. The boat captain had received an extravagant fee from them, a partial compensation for the whispers and fear the reclusive women engendered among his superstitious crew. The captain turned south and skirted the shoreline, heading for a village dock from which his passengers would have a more comfortable walk up to the castle. One of the women in black stared through her gauzy face mesh at the towering new statue of Duke Paulus Atreides on a spit of land, holding bright flames in a brazier on his uplifted palm. She seemed to have become a statue herself, profiled against the ruddy sky of late afternoon. Without a word of thanks to the captain, the four sisters disembarked onto the dock and walked through the old town. Villagers mended nets, boiled pots of shellfish, and tended greenwood fires in smokehouses, watching the visitors with curiosity. Exotic and mysterious, the sisters in isolation were rarely seen away from their fortress nunneries on Caladan's eastern continent. The sister, at the head of the group, wore cobwebs of silver embroidery stitched into ideograms around the fringes of her robes, fabric tattoos that swirled across the silkweave veil. She glided with determined steps along the steep roadway that led to the edifice of Castle Caladan. By the time the four reached the portcullis gate, full dusk filled the sky with a muted purple of gloaming. Uneasy Atreides guards blocked their passage. Without speaking, the woman in silver embroidery separated from the others and drew very close to the men, where she stood calmly, enigmatically. A young soldier rushed to the castle to fetch Thufir Hawat. When the Mentat emerged from the courtyard beyond the gate, he adjusted his formal uniform to create an intimidating presence. With Mentat eyes, he studied the women, but could glean no information from their muffled figures. "The Duke has retired for the evening, but he will open his doors to the populace for 2 hours tomorrow morning." The lead woman reached up to her fine woven veil. Hawat analyzed her movements,
saw how the silver embroidery threads on her black dress were not simply decoration, but a form of sensor net enclosing the person within it. Richesian technology. Taking a step back, he touched the dueling dagger at his hip, but did not draw it. Calmly, she plucked the stitches that bound the silken veil to her hood, ripped the fabric, and pulled away the mask that had altered her features. Thufir Hawat, would you deny me access to my rightful home? Her identity revealed, she blinked in the dim light, and met his gaze without wavering. Would you forbid me to see my own son? Even the unflappable Mentat was taken by surprise. He bowed slightly, then gestured for her to accompany him into the courtyard. But he did not greet her with any form of welcome. Of course not, Lady Helena. You may enter. He motioned for the guards to let the hooded sisters pass. When they were inside the courtyard, Hawat told them to wait, and commanded the guards, Form a thorough weapons scan on these women while I notify the Duke. Leto Atreides sat on a dark wooden chair in his receiving hall. He had pulled on a dress jacket, as well as the golden chain and medallion that signified his rank as a Duke of the Landsraad. He wore such trappings only on grimly formal occasions, such as this one. Even without confirmation from Romber and Gurney, he could not delay his plans. He'd spent the day in military preparations, and, despite Duncan Idaho's brash confidence, Leto knew the battle for Ix would be an unpredictable and dangerous undertaking. He had no time, no patience, and no love for his exiled mother. Glow-globes surrounded him, but did not drive back the shadows in his heart. Leto felt a chill that had nothing to do with the cold mists of evening. He had not seen Helena in 21 years, not since her insidious involvement in the death of her own husband, the old Duke. When she entered, Leto did not rise from his seat. "Close the doors," he said, his voice iron. "We require privacy, and leave those other women to wait in the corridor." Lady Helena's auburn hair had become streaked with gray, her skin drawn tight over facial bones.
"They are my attendants, Leto. They have accompanied me from the eastern continent. Surely you can offer them some hospitality."
"I'm not in a hospitable mood, Mother." "Duncan and Thufir, you two remain with me." Duncan Idaho, still proudly holding Paulus's sword, waited by the lower step of the ducal platform. With a troubled expression, he looked from Leto to his mother, and then to the stony expression of suppressed anger on Hawat's leathery face. The warrior Mentat escorted the still-hooded personal attendants out of the room, then swung the heavy doors shut with a sound that echoed throughout the hall.